make a start. Just lovely in our troubled world to just have some time in the peace and quiet of each other's company and fellowship and friendship. And how blessed we are to live this side of the world. We're delighted to have several visitors with us this evening. Verity and Michael, our brother Michael, be speaking to us. It's lovely to see you both for the second of Michael's talks. So welcome to those that are watching online. And we're going to have a short reading from Matthew 13 from the ESV, verse 24 to verse 43. We very much look forward to the words of our brother Michael. Many things in parables.
Thanks, Graham. Good evening, everyone. It's lovely to be back among you again to look at the second half of this series of studies we're doing on parables, many things in parables. Now, obviously, in two nights, we're not even really going to just blow the dust off the surface of this subject. There's some really, really interesting work that's been done on the parables in more recent decades, particularly as people have tried to get back into the Middle Eastern cultural context, back into the times of Jesus, and to try to understand the parables in their cultural setting, and also in sort of the background of Jesus as a Jew, if you like. And an author like Brad Young has written a book called The Parables of Jesus, where he looks very closely at Jesus' use of them from a Jewish perspective. Another author called Kenneth Bailey has written two books. I can't remember the second of them. It's called A Poet and Peasant and Through Poet's Eyes. There you go. It just came to me. You'll find them published together these days in one combined volume. Brilliant work. He was a Protestant missionary who went back to the Middle East. He lived in Egypt, in Lebanon, in Israel, in Syria. And he lived in villages with, you know, peasants still living there today and living a largely agricultural lifestyle. And as he came to understand their culture, he saw the many, many connections between what he saw around him, even in the 20th century, and the parables of Jesus. So Kenneth Bailey, Brad Young, probably others as well, if you want to take the subject further, there's some really fascinating work that will give you even, you know, more levels of insight into these very well-known stories. But believe me, there's still a lot of depth there to be discovered. So tonight we want to look at the second of our studies on the parables. Now, one of the things that I'll just mention, because Stephen came up to me afterwards and he said, "Oh, you've handed out this list of parables," and of course, you know, there's always a little bit of uncertainty at the edges. Is this a parable or not? Do we count it or not? But he said, "There's nothing on there from the Gospel of John." Now, that's a really, really good observation, and it's worth noting that, because there are no formal parables in the Gospel of John that are identified as parables. But of course, in that Gospel too, there are many stories, extended metaphors that are very similar to a parable, and in many ways they should also be on the list. So one that comes to mind is the long section on Jesus as the Good Shepherd. In John chapter 10, for example, there's a section for verse 1 to verse 18, then there's a little bit of a break while he engages in some sort of to and fro with the Pharisees, and then he comes back to it for another five or six verses. So that's a good example of where in the Gospel of John also there is this kind of material. So, you know, there's an endless scope for us to look at this subject and to study what Jesus had to say. Well, we looked last time at Jesus, the master teacher, astonishing his audience. And we looked at some of his vivid epigrams, such as "A city on a hill cannot be hidden." Right, so it's both a promise and a warning to our society, isn't it? To the church, if you like, to say, well, if you're living like a wonderful sort of communal life, living out the principles of Jesus, you will be a light to the world. But of course, if you are not, and you're, you know, riddled with infighting and there's abuse going on and it's a corrupt and an oppressive society, well, the world won't miss that either. And we've seen both, haven't we, in the history of the church. So it's both a warning and a promise. "If a blind man leads a blind man, both will fall into a pit," said Jesus. That's another example of his epigram. So just warning that if we're going to attach ourselves to a teacher or to a leader, we better make sure that they are eyes open, well informed with the principles and the teachings of Jesus, so that they really can give us a steer in life and not lead us into a pit or into the ditch instead. Jesus also asked challenging questions. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? We don't need James McLean here to tell us that the answer is no, right? Trees, bushes produce according to their species. So if you want grapes, you go to a vine. If you want figs, you go to a fig tree. But there again, Jesus is in that sort of challenging question, if you like. Jesus is saying, and he goes on to spell out his meaning, you know people by their fruits, right? If people are consistently difficult, selfish, oppressive, well, then you're not dealing with a good fruit tree. So, and of course, if you see consistently good fruit, you know you're dealing with someone who's human, will make mistakes, sure, might have some difficult aspects to their personality, but on the whole, they are a source of good fruit because they're in touch with the ethic of Jesus. So these are examples of Jesus' vivid teachings, but of course what we're looking at is mastery of the parable, a short story with a spiritual meaning. And there's a number of these in the Old Testament. The rabbis contemporary with Jesus and after Jesus also adopted this form with varying degrees of skill. But Jesus is the master, no question. And we looked finally last time at why Jesus used this form. Why did he use parables? Does anyone have a view on that or a memory from last time or decades of knowledge have given them some insight into this subject? I'm looking at Stephen. I could look at Sam, probably look at others as well. So why did Jesus use parables?
It's like a constant day to remind of them too, of principle.
Right, yes, they're very memorable, aren't they? Like they're stories, you learn them in Sunday school as a little kid and you never forget the story or its overall point. Yep, that's undoubtedly one of the reasons why he did that.
To use a parable, it's to separate sheep from goats.
Yes.
In other words, it made people either, as we just read tonight, ask for more information.
Yes.
Or to walk away.
Yep.
So it was a kind of prejudgment.
Yep, very good. Absolutely right. So that's also an important reason why Jesus used parables. So they got people's attention, they were entertaining, they were memorable, but they also acted, as you've said, Stephen, as a filter. And in fact, in the Gospels, it uses the term inside and outside, or sheep and goats, as you use that terminology. So it didn't mean the disciples were smarter than anybody else. They weren't. They were quite ordinary people, I suppose, much like us. They weren't spiritual geniuses. And a lot of the time, they were bamboozled by what Jesus was saying. But the difference between them and probably the academically advanced scribes and lawyers was that they had no interest in what Jesus had to say, really, and they just shrugged and moved on or looked for something to pick on. Whereas his disciples and lots of other ordinary people said, oh, wow, I don't know what Jesus is talking about, but I really want to know. And so they would follow him into the house or they'd tag along until they got him into a quiet place. And then they would ask the question, what do you mean? Sometimes even Jesus himself was a little bit surprised at their lack of insight. And sometimes he's even provoked to say, don't you even get it? I suppose he was just so in tune with God and so clear about what he was thinking, it seemed obvious to him. But he was always willing to explain to anybody who asked. He was very approachable, and that's why we see a number of times in the Gospels Jesus spelling out step by step, patiently, the meaning of a parable. Now, we're going to just have a look at his method now. Oh, in just a minute. One final slide, if you like. We also looked at what can we look for when we're exploring a parable. And we've got 7 C's here, which is a little corny, I guess. But we need to look at the context of the parable, like where does it sit in a set or what's said immediately before or after it. Does it arise out of a confrontation between Jesus and other people? The construction of the parable, is it very short and pithy, or is it an extended story, almost heading toward a short story? Who are the characters and what are their points of view do they represent? What's the content and the colour in the story as a piece of art? Do they involve creative distortion? Like often they do. Often the parables include an element of unreality, which sort of challenges us, gets our attention. We say, oh, hang on. That's a lot of bread to bake. Well, a lot of leaven to put in a loaf, or a mustard bush, as we read in the reading tonight. Well, it doesn't really grow into a tree. Like, that is a big exaggeration, right? But Jesus used these elements to highlight things he was drawing attention to and to make his parables memorable. Jesus uses comparison or contrast, and often there's a twist or a punchline to the parable which highlights the confrontation and the crisis. Jesus is using the parables to bring us face to face with God and to eternal realities, and that's one way he sort of shocks us into confronting the decisions that we need to make. So there's a lot in this subject. It's not material for kids, all right? That's often where we're first introduced to it, but it's something from which we can learn our whole life long as we explore the parables in a bit more depth. Now, we want to take these principles and we want to apply them to two great parables. So I've prepared some worksheets. So what I'm asking you to do, we'll have right, or groups of three, five here, so you don't have to work that out. Go through the parables of the sower and seed in the soils, and you'll see on the left-hand side, there's all the key features of the parable. And then in the chapter, only a few verses down, Jesus will give a detailed explanation of it, and we'll step through the parable, point by point, and give a detailed analytical breakdown of his meaning. Okay, you'll see that in the chapter. Similarly, in Matthew's Gospel, in Matthew 13, with a lesser-known parable, still a very important parable, the weeds among the wheat. And the reason I think it's important is because Jesus does the same thing with that parable, right? He first of all tells the parable, and then a little bit later in the chapter, and a few verses later, his disciples say, please tell us what it means, and he gives it the same detailed treatment as he does for the parable of the sower, the seed, and the sower, okay? And tells us exactly what it's all about. And the reason is because it covers a very important topic, right? Which is, if this is God's work, and we're engaged in that, and it's all heading toward the success of the kingdom, why do we have to put up with all the evil and the trouble and the difficulty along the way? What's going on? Why does God allow that? Will there be a resolution of those problems? And that's a really important challenge, isn't it? We face often every day, and Jesus sort of deals with that in that parable, and that's what I think is also given that extended treatment. So groups of two or three, and just work through the parable, have a look at the explanation and identify what the parable means. I'll just give you 5 minutes for that. Five, maybe seven. Yes, there's spare handouts there. There's also, there were some at the back of the room. Mm-hmm. What are you missing out?
We thought the weeds among the wheat was what we're seeing.
Question two? Has everyone found the parable and the explanation thereof? So they're both in Matthew chapter 13, and you'll find the explanation just 5 or 6 verses after the parable itself. There's a little words in between. All good?
Are we supposed to connect with the second parable, or only the first one of the reading?
Distinct parables.
Because it's trading with two.
In the second one, there is a specific statement of what the sower
has seen. Yeah, not in the first one. Okay, the sower sows up there, doesn't it? In the first one.
Yeah, well, that's the third one.
The one I sold, yes.
But in the second one, there are.
Yeah, you're in the sun,
man. Yeah, it's like a program.
Like we just spread it. Yeah. So it's not obvious. That's like the soil.
Yeah, it's got to be something.
Okay, so we might reluctantly draw a line under our time now. Who looked at the parable of the sower, the seed, and the soil? Put your hand up, please. Ah, yes, very good. Okay, so we have got a few. Okay, so would you like to tell us then, what did Jesus say? Who did Jesus say the sower was? He doesn't. No, you're right. Okay, so it wasn't meant to be a trick question, but he doesn't actually identify himself as the sower. The next parable, the parable of the weeds among the wheat, Jesus says explicitly the sower is the Son of Man, right? So it's the very next parable. So I think we can safely assume that he intended that the sower should represent himself, but he doesn't actually say that, right, in the interpretation. What then is the seed? What's the seed? The word, yeah. Which it means in this context, doesn't mean the Bible as such. It means the message that Jesus is preaching, right? The gospel is probably the term we would commonly use, but it's often called the word of God or the word in the New Testament. What's the action of sowing? Stephen?
It's not the same. The seeds are not the same in the second parable.
No.
One would assume they are meant to be. So it's actually more about who is putting out the word, not the word itself.
Yeah.
The second parable is the sons of the kingdom.
Yep. Yep.
In other words, it doesn't get distributed without a person doing it.
Now, interesting. So each parable's got its own logic and they can be slightly different, although they can also throw light on each other, which is helpful. So what's the action of sowing then in this first parable?
Preaching.
Preaching, all right. So Jesus is out there broadcasting the word. The very term broadcast that we use for mass communication these days comes from sowing, right? That's the original meaning of the word, to broadcast. The hard trodden path, what does that represent? The first category of soil.
Those who don't understand.
Yep. They don't understand. And why don't they understand? It gives us a clue in the interpretation.
Well, they hear, but it doesn't settle in their heart.
Doesn't settle. Along come the birds, bang, it's gone, isn't it? It doesn't even get a chance to take any kind of root. The second category is the shallow soil. What does that represent?
Well, they hear and they receive it with joy.
Yes.
So that is some root.
Yep.
It doesn't last very long. It's not very deep.
It doesn't last very long. So what is the rapid growth is also explained, isn't it? Because they receive the word with joy, but then along comes the sun, right? And what happens to the...
It's because they have no root.
Yep. And Jesus explains what he's... like. What's the analogy then?
When trials and stuff come into people's lives.
Yeah. That joy can evaporate, they lose their faith, and of course then the seed just withers and dies, doesn't it, right? So that's a bit of a caution to us. We need to be in for the long haul when we're listening to Jesus. Stephen?
I think there's maybe an accidental parallel. There's the term shallow soil.
Yep.
I would equate to shallow minded.
Maybe that's what Jesus had in mind. Like, it certainly doesn't penetrate very far, does it? There's this, you know, really exuberant initial response, but fairly soon, he says, trouble comes along and that feeling evaporates and the seed is lost. All right, what about the third category of soil? It's sown among what? Thorns? And what does Jesus say they represent?
Cares of this world, deceitfulness of riches.
Yeah. In Mark's gospel, he says the cares of this life, the deceitfulness of riches, and the lusts of other things entering in, right? So there's a whole host of things that can sort of crowd out the fruitfulness from our lives, can't they, right? And then not even necessarily always bad things in themselves, but the simple bulk of them can squash out the seed, and there's no time for God. He gets crowded out, and so no fruit comes. All right, what about the good soil then?
They hear, they understand, and are fruitful.
Yes, that's right. So if any of you were at the Combine weekend, there were some really, really interesting illustrations from nature about the, you know, fecundity of nature. It's very, very prolific and fruitful, and one seed can multiply so quickly into thousands or millions of seeds if it's given the opportunity. And this parable was quoted as an illustration of that. Right, so what's the sort of the return on the seed in this parable? What does Jesus say? Verse 8, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30, right? Even 30 was an incredibly good return for the kinds of wheat that were available to farmers in those days. So a farmer would have been delighted with any of those returns. But there's this abundant response, isn't it? And what does that represent? More believers? Yes, that would be some of the fruits. More seeds, yeah.
And it's an exaggeration, isn't it? Because you never get 100-fold.
In real life.
Yeah.
Even today.
Yeah, there may be one or two extraordinary preachers do something like that, but it's...
Well, in the wheat.
Yes. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes, okay, yeah.
The brother of the farmers told us that you'd never get 100-fold.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary...
One head of corn.
Right.
The wheat, sorry.
Yeah.
You never get 100.
But of course, yeah, so that's an example of how Jesus uses exaggeration. He was really trying to get his hearers, a lot of whom were farmers, to say, wow, I've never had anything like that. And he's making them think, isn't he? He's making us think. And of course, he's talking about good works, isn't he? The proliferation of good works in response to the gospel in the lives of believers. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. And that it brings forth fruit and patience.
Very good. And honest and good people bringing forth fruit with patience, that's like everyday life, isn't it? It's being kind to your neighbour, it's being generous with someone on the bus, it's being helpful at work and so on. So all those everyday challenges that we face, Jesus wants that fruitfulness from us. Okay, let's have a look at the second parable then. Yes.
I think it highlights something else in regards to sort of preaching of the word.
Yeah.
As you say, it's about everyday life.
Yeah.
In that not everybody is going to respond to the preaching of the word.
Yeah.
But I find the most important thing about this is that the sower keeps sowing.
Right.
Doesn't stop.
Doesn't give up.
Just because the seed lands on the hard ground or something, it keeps sowing all the time. And that's a real lesson for us, that we've got to keep sowing all the time. Sure, not everybody's going to accept the word of God, but if we stop sowing, then no one's going to get that opportunity. We have to continue sowing.
Yep. No, really good observation, Joel. Thank you.
The other one is that I noticed with that, Michael, is the servants come to him in verse 27 of the household and said, "Sir." Oh, it's the wheat and the tares,
Well, we'll get onto that right now. So, join us.
It's only in the context that he doesn't allow the servants to sow. He sowed it himself. That's what they're saying.
Right,
So. Which is kind of a comparison to the sower when we think about ourselves often being also a sower.
Okay,
Technically, we are the good seed.
It's still the son of God. Yeah, so there's these little subtleties that are often woven into the parable where Jesus is, you know, careful, makes a careful distinction about the moral reality that is slightly different sometimes from the everyday reality of the story. Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Tim. Well, let's have a look at the weeds among the wheat now. Who's the estate owner? The Son of Man, right? Jesus himself. What's the field? The world. Did you say that? No? Who was that? Oh, Lisa. Very good. It's just this quiet voice. I couldn't work out where it's coming from. I'll turn my hearing aid up. Hang on. The field is the world, all right, which I suppose in the original context is the Jewish world, if you like. Like, that would have been the sort of the boundaries. But, of course, that general term is used, and, of course, now it really means the world as a whole. What's the seed there? The sons of the kingdom. The sons of the kingdom, yes, right. The good seed, us as believers. Along comes somebody else to sort of spoil the party or spoil the harvest. Who's that?
The devil.
The devil, right? The enemy is the devil, right? And what does the devil sow in this field that's initially full of good seed and growing wheat?
Tares,
right? We don't have time to go into the detail of that tonight, but it's a small poisonous seed. It looks like wheat in the early stages when it's growing. It's hard to tell the difference. By the time it gets to harvest, the difference is quite obvious. If you're not careful with the harvest, you'll end up with a few seeds of that in among the wheat. And when you bake it for people or you serve it to cattle or whatever it might be, it will make them sick, right? It's not fatal, but it is toxic, and it would give them a bad stomach ache. So, you certainly don't want that ruining your crop, right? But there it is. And what do the tares represent then? The children of the wicked one, right? So people who are motivated quite differently, aren't they? Like they love power and they are corrupt and they love money. And so they're motivated by very different things from the children of the kingdom. And there they are sort of coexisting side by side in the same field. Now, that of course is a figure for the coexistence of good and evil in life today. We're not always surrounded by good people. Sometimes we have to deal with difficult and evil people as well. Now,
it's a cameo of his disciples, because he said, "Have I not chosen you 12, and one of you is a devil?"
Right, yes, that's right. Yep. So it became apparent, didn't it, over time, that even in that small little circle there was one, you know, bad seed. Okay, someone spots the problem, an observant, a group of people. Who are they? And who do they represent?
Doesn't specifically say.
Okay.
It's the impression of the disciples, maybe?
Yeah. It doesn't say, you're right.
It
so,
the angels.
Yeah, it could be the angels. But both of which are his servants, right? Both groups are his servants. So it could be either or both of those. But they spot the problem, And they go to their Lord, sort of anxious about this. What do you want us to do about it? Do you want us to pull out the tares, remove the evil, so the world is just filled with unmixed good? And, of course, he says, no, don't do that. You need to wait until harvest time. What does harvest time represent? The end of the world, all right? The crisis of the day of the Lord, the return of Jesus and the establishment of God's kingdom. So the last judgment. So that's harvest time. And the good is all gathered into the barn, isn't it? Because that's treasured. But first of all, the tares are pulled out one by one and then they're burned to make sure they don't create any problem then or in the future. So what does the burning of the tares represent? Jesus gives that an analogy. Yes, the judgment of the wicked, that's right, and they're sort of they're figuratively burned. But the wheat is preserved, which is a sort of a metaphor for what?
Immortality,
yeah, right. They're gathered into his garner. So Jesus treasures every single seed of wheat, and he will ensure it is preserved. Right, so there's two very memorable stories, right, and they both cover some really important ground. One talks to us about our response to the gospel, and unlike soil, we choose our response, and that response can change over time, can't it? So we don't have to say, well, I'm the path, you know, bad luck, I can't respond. No, you can choose to be the good soil, right? Unlike soil itself, which is a passive thing. So our response to the gospel is determined by us, and Jesus talks about that and the fruitfulness that should follow. And then in the parable of the weeds among the wheat, he says you need to be patient, because you will be dealing with trial and difficulty and difficult people all the way through to the final judgment. And you just need to be patient about that, because I will deal with that in my time. Now, that just shows, doesn't it, when we look closely at the parables, how much teaching is in them, right? And maybe not every parable has that same, you know, step-by-step breakdown. Maybe not every point has that kind of, you know, loaded meaning. Maybe it just contributes to the flow of the story. But it teaches us to look, doesn't it? Have a good look at a parable, because it could be telling us a whole lot more than appears on the surface. Now, what was Jesus communicating? We don't have much time to look at this now, so I'm not going to try and scramble through. But a lot of the parables are identified specifically as parables of the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus will even start the parable saying, the kingdom of heaven is like, and he'll say it's like a grain of mustard seed that's thrown into the soil, and the man then goes to bed and he wakes up, nothing's happened, right? A few weeks go by, and then all of a sudden there's a little green shoot, and he keeps his eye on that, and over the coming weeks the green shoot sprouts, a stalk, robust stalk develops, then there's a green ear, and finally a full head of ripe grain, okay? How does that happen, says Jesus? You know, the gospel is sown, and it's about the kingdom of heaven. In that case, the point is that it is God's work, God at work, and this is divine activity that's producing its fruitfulness. It's not about us. We're just pretty much bystanders as we watch this amazing miracle unfold. Now, you know, all the parables, in a sense, are teaching something about the kingdom, aren't they? But these ones are specifically identified as relating to the kingdom of heaven. So I've just included those on the list. And look at the things Jesus has to say about the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God in these parables. The first thing that he shows us in a couple of parables, he makes the point that the final outcome will be out of all proportion to the beginning. Right, so often this point is made with people who are critical of Christianity, isn't it? Like it was just a small thing. Who even was Jesus, you know? He's only mentioned in a handful of places outside the Bible. Well, of course, small beginnings, and Jesus himself said that. It's just one little mustard seed. I don't know if you've ever looked at a jar of seeded mustard, right? And there's this tiny little round balls in it. That's a mustard seed, right? It's a very insignificant thing. And yet it can grow into quite a sizable bush. Now, Jesus calls it a tree. He's exaggerating for effect, right? But he's asking us to think about the difference between that tiny seed and what comes of that. It's out of all proportion to the size of the original seed. And so it is with the kingdom of God, right? The final outcome will be something. Is that a picture of a mustard plant?
That's a real mustard seed.
Okay.
In fact, it's so small you can hardly
There you go. Right. Very useful plant, the mustard. Right. Broccoli, Brussels sprouts, kale, cauliflower, mustard itself, and a number of other vegetables all come from the one plant. It's an incredibly useful plant. And it was well known even in the days of Jesus. Cauliflower was being grown even then. And kids loved it. The mustard seed grows into this big, impressive and useful bush, right? Just like the kingdom of God started with something very small. And probably by about 100 AD, there were 100,000 believers in the world. And then it sort of took over the empire, didn't it? It became a very dominant religion with all kinds of problems that brought in its wake. But nevertheless, something very impressive. And of course, when the kingdom of God is fully realized, it will be incredibly powerful and impressive. And the same lesson is taught in the parable of the leaven in the loaf, right? The leaven's hidden away. You can't see the leaven. It's mixed in with the flour and the water and so on. But then all of a sudden, out of this small ball of dough comes a big and impressive loaf, particularly given the quantities that the woman is said to bake in that parable. So there's one thing that Jesus says. He says that it's worth everything we have. And he gives a couple of parables that talk about that. He talks about a person just walking through a field, looking nowhere in particular, whistling, and all of a sudden he stubs his toe on a corner of a box. And when he scrapes the dirt away, there's treasure hidden in the field. He can't believe it. And he goes away and sells everything he has in order to buy that field and access that treasure. In the very next parable, the merchant seeking fine pearls, there's an obsessive merchant. He really knows the value of pearls. He knows his pearls. And he scours the world, travelling all over the Middle East to find the finest pearls. And one day he comes across the pearl of a lifetime. He's never seen anything like it before. And he sells everything else, the rest of his collection, everything he owns, in order to buy that one pearl, because for him that's almost like, he's reached peak pearl in his life. So Jesus is telling us in those two parables that it's worth everything we have, right? This is an incredible treasure, and it's worth giving up everything in order to access this treasure. He tells us that we choose our response, but fruitfulness is expected, and we've explored that in the parable of the sower, the seed and the soil. I talked before about the seed growing unawares. The farmer scatters his seed, and then after that, pretty much it's up to the weather, isn't it? It's just the sun and the rain doing their thing, and up comes the wheat or the grain. And of course, the point Jesus is making is that this growth that happens is generated by God. It's a miraculous thing that he is doing to produce that wonderful, wonderful growth. Evil will be mixed with good. Wait till the judgment. And we've looked at the parable of the weeds among the wheat. Just have a look in the chapter we read tonight, in Matthew chapter 13. There's another very short parable, but it's making a similar point. In fact, there's arguably five parables in this chapter that have a dimension or an element of this same issue of mixed good and evil. And here's another one that's quite explicit about that in verse 47, the parable of the dragnet. Says again, the kingdom of heaven is like. See that introductory phrase? Doesn't mean the other parables are not relevant to the kingdom, but there's some that are specifically labelled in that way. The kingdom of heaven is like a net that was thrown into the sea and gathered fish of every kind. It's quite indiscriminate, right? They just walked out into the water or threw the net from a boat or from a projecting rock. On the back of the toilet door at home at the moment, there's a Japanese calendar, right? And it's got a Japanese fisherman doing exactly that, standing on a rocky promontory, and it's a print from the 19th century, and he's putting in his net and hoping for a haul of fish. But he can't decide what fish go into that net, can he? He just throws out his net, and then he takes what comes. And when he pulls in the net, when it was full, men drew it ashore and sat down, and look, there's good fish and bad fish mixed in, some you can't even eat. Right? And some are good. And so you had to go through it and discriminate, sort the good into containers, throw away the bad, right? So it will be at the end of the age. And so Jesus draws the spiritual lesson. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So there'll be this sorting process, if you like, to discriminate between good and evil, and that's out of our hands. That's handled by the Lord himself and by his angels. Probably a good thing too. Now, Jesus says All is grace, but we must respond appropriately. What's the story of the labourers in the vineyard? Give us the 25 words or less version. What happened? Yeah. So some start at the beginning of the day and then progressively through the day, right through till about 1 hour before closing time, the master of the vineyard is still pulling in the workers, but they all got exactly the same amount regardless of how long they went. It caused a bit of disgruntlement, didn't it? Because he started with those he'd hired most recently and they got a penny. Well, they would have thought, that's a very good return. This guy is very generous. Thank you very much. There's no way I deserve a penny, right? I've only been working for an hour. Really appreciate your generosity. We're going to get fed tonight. And he works his way along the line to those hired at the beginning of the day, and they get exactly what they're entitled to, their contractual payment, one penny. They say, hang on, we worked for 10 hours, he worked for one. Why are we getting the same amount? Jesus said, it's up to the Lord, isn't it? It's his goods. He can do what he likes with it. And if he chooses to be generous, who are you to complain? So it's an act of grace is the reward that God gives for our labour in his service. And yet we still have to respond appropriately, don't we? If we're invited to the wedding, we're a guest at the wedding, we're not entitled to that invitation, but lo and behold, suddenly, unexpectedly, we've been pulled out of a ditch, and here we are at the wedding. Wow, what a turn of events. And yet you have to be dressed appropriately for the occasion, says the parable, right? So even though God has shown tremendous grace to us in giving us this invitation, none of us are entitled to that in any sense, right, or deserve it. Yet here we are, well, we've still got to respond appropriately, says Jesus, right? Don't take it for granted, right? Don't take the Lord for granted. Respond appropriately. Mercy will be received in measure as we show it. And he tells the parable of the unforgiving servant. What happened in that parable? Matthew chapter 18, what happened? Do you remember the parable?
He gets forgiven of a massive debt.
Yes.
Goes out and doesn't forgive the debt that's owed to him.
Exactly right. And Jesus tells it very graphically, doesn't he? He says, you know, like this man had nothing. There's no way he could pay off his debt. And the king says, what, throw him in jail and his wife and his children, right, until he can pay. Well, of course, in jail, it's even more impossible. And he begs and pleads and he's let off the debt. It's just written off, right? Does he appreciate that? No, he doesn't. He goes out into the street, grabs his fellow servant by the neck and says, you pay me now or I'll throw you into prison. And it was just a relatively small amount, right? So no appreciation. And other people looking on are horrified at his attitude. They tell the Lord, and of course, the debt cancellation is reversed. So what's Jesus warning us about in that parable, do you think?
Forgive as you've been forgiven.
Absolutely, right? We want mercy from God, and we all want that. We all want God to look at us kindly and to be, you know, patient with our faults and tolerant of our weaknesses and to give us time. And so all of that is what we want from God. Well, we have to show that to each other as well, right? God is expecting that kind of attitude to others as well that we've received from him. And then finally, of course, the well-known parable of the 10 bridesmaids, where the whole story is about don't miss the opportunity, right? Be prepared, be ready, have oil in your lamps, because when the moment comes, you just want to go with Jesus. You don't want to be running off trying to buy oil at midnight and so on and then miss out on the wedding to find yourself on the wrong side of the door. So there's all these very vivid parables that Jesus tells. Those ones in particular are about the kingdom of heaven, but there's much more that he teaches in the other parables that he gives. Now, this is what my other handout was supposed to be about, but we're not going to be able to access that tonight. So just so you know, now I'm confusing myself even here. On the back of the weeds among the wheat, you'll see that what I started to do, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry about this, what Jesus taught through the parables, I sort of grouped them under broad headings, right? So Jesus' new teaching and its impact, God's searching love. How should we respond to Jesus' call? We need to listen and we need to do, right? Jesus is not just looking for interest. He wants action. How should we live? Let your light shine. Be prepared to finish what you start, says Jesus, right? It's no point in making an impressive start on discipleship and then finding that you just haven't got the stamina or the resources to follow it through to its successful conclusion. Be forgiving. Be a good neighbour. Use money in a way that pleases God, right? And it's not just about storing it up for your indulgence. Prayer, the importance of persistent prayer. How to be a consistent servant of Jesus and so on. So there's a lot of different themes that Jesus picked out, and he supported them all through this use of parables. So look, thanks very much for the time that we've had together over these two nights. Like we said, we're just really blowing the dust off the surface of this subject, but I hope you can take away the idea that there's much more here than just the genuine but straightforward meanings you might have picked up in Sunday school. There's a lot of depth in these stories, and they're worth a close read to see what Jesus, the master teacher, embedded in these extraordinary stories. Thanks very much.